Kido Butai and Admiral Kondo's advance force to resume the counteroffensive for Guadalcanal. As the sun rose on September 13th, pilots of the Hornet ferried those 18 badly needed Wildcats to Guadalcanal. Then noise had the carriers race to the east toward Santa Cruz to keep that all-important flanking position and be prepared to strike. Garmley implemented Admiral Turner's plan for moving the 7th Marine Regiment to Guadalcanal, and at 5:15 on September 14th, Turner took his normal flagship transport, Macaulay, plus the transports Crescent City, President Adams, President Hayes, President Jackson, and Alchiba. The 7th Marines were finally going to join the fight. So important was this convoy that it would have its own screen, the new Task Force 64, under Rear Admiral Carlton Wright. Just created, about a month late, grumbled Admiral King, Task Force 64 was to perform screening, escort, and attack functions, and it could always run errands. It would consist of whatever cruisers and destroyers they could find lying around. For this mission, it consisted of the flagship heavy cruiser Minneapolis, light cruisers USS Boise and HMNZS Leander, and more than a dozen destroyers and minesweepers. Admiral Turner had his ships head east to avoid Japanese aerial reconnaissance and get some semblance of protection from the Wasp and Hornet. The only problem was that Turner's course took him and the carriers into the same area where the Saratoga had been torpedoed a few weeks earlier. The Japanese had figured out some time ago that the sea routes from Espiritu Santo to Guadalcanal all passed through the same relatively small stretch of water and had stationed a picket line of submarines along this route. The continued sightings of and attacks by Japanese submarines had already earned the stretch the moniker Torpedo Junction. But there was little choice. If you wanted to supply Guadalcanal, you had to go through Torpedo Junction. Admiral Noyes had more on his mind than submarines, because he and the combined fleet were performing their own version of the Danse Macabre that would be repeated many times over the course of the campaign. The Americans would advance, the Japanese would pull back, then the Japanese would advance, and the Americans would pull back. The distance between them remained much the same, and they couldn't quite come to grips with each other. These few days were typical of the Danse Macabre. At around 11 a.m. on September 13th, a PBY out of Espiritu Santo reported two Japanese cruisers near Santa Cruz. Thinking it might be a major fleet element, Admiral Noyes raced toward it to launch an airstrike. But the follow-ups found no cruisers. Meanwhile, at 11:10 a.m., Special Duty Lieutenant J.G. Mizukura Kiyoshi, commanding one of the new Kawanishi H-8K Type 2 Emily flying boats of the 14th Air Group, reported one of the American carriers. Now the Japanese raced toward the Americans, but the Wasp and Hornet pulled back out of strike range. The next day, it was the reverse. Admiral Noyes was trying to keep the carriers positioned between Admiral Turner's convoy and the Japanese. At 10:45, a PBY commanded by Lieutenant Glenn E. Hoffman reported four battleships and seven carriers 325 miles north-northwest of the Wasp and Hornet and closing. Did the Japanese even have seven aircraft carriers? No matter. Despite apparently being badly outnumbered, Admiral Noyes decided to launch an airstrike on this force to protect the transports. At 11:40, Hoffman issued an unsurprising correction to his earlier report, the contacts now being three battleships, four cruisers, four destroyers, and one transport. Hoffman had found Admiral Kondo's advance force, northwest of Santa Cruz, probing for the American carrier reported the previous day. Another report came in from a Catalina just before noon, a Japanese carrier, along with three cruisers and four destroyers. Lieutenant J.G. Baxter E. Moore, commanding this Catalina out of Espiritu Santo, had found Admiral Nagumo's Kido Butai, but he would not live to tell about it. Horrified listeners in the radio rooms of Admiral Noyes' ships heard Moore declare, "We're going down in flames!" Neither he nor his crew were ever heard from again. Six Zeros from the Shokaku had found and destroyed the PBY. Noyes sent up an airstrike at 1:15 p.m. to deal with this obviously grave threat. Then, more than 2 hours later, the seaplane tender Curtis relayed an update from Lieutenant Hoffman. Now it was the Japanese who were heading away. Their own searches had found nothing, and Admiral Kondo was heading north to refuel. The American airstrike returned having found nothing. The only attack that day was in the late afternoon by 10 flying fortresses of the 11th Bombardment Group out of Espiritu Santo, who managed to nick the cruiser Myoko with a near miss. Would the Dance of Death resume the next day? The morning of September 15th found the two U.S. carriers staying about 100 miles north of Admiral Turner's convoy. Knowing Kidubutai was on the prowl, Turner was edgy, waiting for developments to decide if he would continue toward Guadalcanal. An otherwise quiet morning ended when a Japanese Mavis flying boat, this one commanded by veteran Lieutenant Yoneyama Shigeru of the Toko Air Group, had spotted the reinforcement at about 11.05 a.m. Four Wasp Wildcats had been vectored to check it out, and one piloted by Lieutenant J.G. John McBrayer sent the Mavis down in flames. The Japanese were now onto them, Turner thought. The situation, in his view, was not reassuring. Hidobutai and Pearl Harbor had not yet taught the U.S. Navy the lesson of grouping its carriers for mutual protection and mass aircraft formations. According to American practice, the two carriers were steaming in separate task forces, with Admiral Noy's Wasp some 7 to 10 miles from Admiral Murray's Hornet. Both were heading southeast to conduct flight operations, which had just concluded. While they were still refueling and arming aircraft, at 2:42 p.m., they all began turning right to a base course of 280 degrees true, west-northwest, to resume the journey to Guadalcanal about 250 miles away. Guarding the convoy was vital, but it was also a tedious job, a dangerous job, because they were steaming right through the dark heart of Torpedo Junction. Sonar contacts occurred at least every day. Making things worse, in the eyes of some sailors, was that the Wasp in particular seemed to be following predictable straight-line courses. Every day at the same time, we were at the same place, going at the same speed on the same course, recalled Wasp radio man Lieutenant Leonard Gross. We were making bets when something was going to happen. But hopefully not today. Today it was a beautiful day, bright, sunny. You could see for miles and miles. A little windy, though, with a 20-knot wind from the east-southeast. It made flight operations easier, but also created white caps on the sea. For the lookouts keeping watch over the sea, white caps were like static on a TV that obscured the true picture. It was easier to spot something in the water by its wake or the contrast between it and the blueness of the water. White caps broke everything up, creating perpetual motion that made it difficult to see anything. Even seeing the white wakes of the escorting ships could be a chore, though it was much easier than seeing wakes where you didn't expect them. On the bridge of the heavy cruiser Pensacola, Ben Blee, the officer of the deck, was not watching the white caps as his ship held station escorting the Hornet. He was watching the Wasp through his binoculars some 12,000 yards away. Something about the Wasp was bugging him. He saw smoke, quite a lot of it, rising from the carrier, from the side away from him, the starboard side. Blee also saw several aircraft floating past the Wasp's stern into her wake. Must have been an aircraft accident, he thought, with those aircraft pushed over the side to eliminate fire hazards. Not a big deal. Happens all the time. That the carrier had sent no message explaining it supported this view. Still, that was an awful lot of smoke. As Blee continued to watch and wonder, the smoke kept coming. Got worse, even. Explosions followed. The Wasp had never completed her turn, and was still headed southeast. Yet she said nothing. Then the Pensacola picked up a frantic, frightening, but frustratingly fragmentary radio report. Torpedo headed for formation, course 080. What formation? Who sent this message? Shortly thereafter came another message just as frantic, just as frightening, and just as fragmentary. Torpedo just passed astern of me, headed for you. It was followed by inaudible crosstalk on the radio. The destroyer Mustin and the Hornet screen finally provided some clarity by hoisting the signal flag from her yardarm, Torpedo. The task force had just settled on their new course of 280 degrees true, when at 2:51 the Hornet's loudspeakers blared with the bosun's whistle, the bugle, and the call, "General quarters, all hands man your battle stations." A few thought they felt a dull crash, like a torpedo hitting a distant target. Several men, running to their posts, recalled hearing an officer say, "The Wasp got three fish in her." The Hornet had to get aircraft in the air, now. Since the Wasp was the duty carrier for the day, and now looked like she could no longer handle it, the Hornet had to provide air cover for herself. She also had to clear space for the returning aircraft from the Wasp to land. On the bridge, Captain Charles P. Mason rang up 30 knots and hard right rudder, then, "Now hard left rudder." hoping the traditional method of zigzagging would throw off the enemy aim. As heartless as it might sound, the Hornet had to protect herself, getting as far away as possible from the Wasp and whatever had brought her to grief. It was most probably a submarine, and a submarine could not move quickly while submerged. Seeing his charge's maneuvers, Captain George H. Fort of the North Carolina barked, "Right full rudder! Emergency flank speed!" In the Hornet's air plot, Lieutenant Commander Francis Foley, the air operations officer, was looking out off the port beam toward the Wasp when he saw the destroyer O'Brien, 2,000 yards away, disappear in a giant geyser of water and smoke. Foley's assistant nonchalantly said, "Scratch one, small boy," and crossed out the destroyer's name on a blackboard of all the nearby screening vessels and their positions. Prematurely, as it turned out, since the O'Brien quickly reappeared, sans her bow, Foley was appalled. The little destroyer had taken a torpedo that would otherwise have hit the Hornet. Before Foley had time to contemplate more than that, he felt a concussion from off the Hornet's port quarter. The battleship North Carolina was still turning, just passing 295 degrees true, when a torpedo smacked her on the port side underneath the number one turret, sending another plume of water, smoke, oil, and debris shooting up as high as her tower mast. As the water came crashing back down onto her deck, one crewman was washed over the side. The North Carolina took a 5-degree list, but shrugged off the hit, continuing to build up speed and keeping her station in the screen. The messages started coming in to Admiral Murray on the flag bridge. The O'Brien signaled, "Torpedo hit forward. CPO quarters destroyed. Casualties. Can make 15 knots. Request permission to remain in company." Then came the battleship. "Large hole, well below waterline, 5 known dead. Damage under control. Can make 25 knots." Every man on the Hornet who could look astern did, watching in dry-mouthed horror, as the Wasp drunkenly staggered in an apparent effort to get the wind to blow off the port quarter the huge pall of inky black smoke that was smothering her. At 3:09, they watched as the most terrible flash they had ever seen engulfed the Wasp's island, blowing men into the air, into the sea, and sending another column of smoke billowing upward like a volcano. They saw what looked like flashes of gunfire coming from the doomed carrier. They were her aircraft and ammunition exploding. They saw sheets of flame around the Wasp's waterline and in her wake, burning fuel on the water. The men kept watching as some now homeless Wasp SBDs approached the Hornet. One dropped a message, "Wasp burning fiercely forward of island. 10-degree list to starboard, guess. 100 men or more aft on flight deck. Destroyer close aboard. 8 Wasp planes due land, 16:20. Wasp dead in water or just barely backing down. Ammunition on deck exploding." What had caused all this? Multiple submarines, they were guessing. Had to be. One submarine couldn't do all this. As the Wasp receded in the distance astern, in her mortal agony, she presented a terrible and yet transfixing sight. The men of the Hornet were mesmerized, clustered in tight, small groups, their jaws clenched, watching their friend die. Just before the Wasp disappeared over the horizon, one officer handed his binoculars to a friend and muttered, "Take your last look at the Wasp." Paying their respects, vowing revenge. They would never forget the sunny, surreal afternoon of September 15, 1942. What precisely happened to the Wasp has never been fully determined. The Japanese submarine I-19, skippered by Lieutenant Commander Kinashi Takakazu, had spent much of the morning tracking sound contacts. At 1:50 p.m., he finally made visual contact, using his periscope, with the sources of the noise. One carrier, one heavy cruiser, and several destroyers, bearing 45 degrees true northeast, distance 9 miles. Kinashi estimated the carrier was heading northwest. They were a long way away, but they were zigzagging, so maybe they would zig toward a good firing position for him. They did better than that. At 2:20 p.m., the force turned southeast to conduct flight operations. The carrier was headed almost straight for him. This was almost too good to be true. The I-19 didn't need to move. Making no noise, the I-19 would be almost impossible to detect before Kinashi could strike, unless the destroyers were running active sonar. Kinashi estimated that the carrier was on course 130 degrees true southeast at 12 knots. He set for a gyro angle of 50 degrees starboard, and at 2:45, Kinoshi launched a spread of what were much later determined to be 6 Type 95 oxygen-propelled torpedoes with a slightly diverging spread at the ludicrously close range of 985 yards. On the Wasp, Lieutenant Gross was making an entry in the carrier's war diary. To buy himself the time to do so, he played a classical concert over the ship's loudspeakers. Ensign John Jenks Mitchell had finished working in the Wasp's starboard forward gun gallery in front of the island. In brilliant sunshine, paired with the somber tones of Franz Schubert's unfinished symphony, Mitchell was starting to head below when one of his gunners asked him, "Mr. Mitchell, what's that funny-looking thing out there?" Mitchell turned to look and saw it coming right at him. "I shouted an alarm in a voice that may be described as similar to a thrilled tenor," Mitchell later said. "Torpedoes!" Another call came at 2:45 from a lookout in the Wasp's tripod mast. Admiral Noy's head swiveled to see, off the starboard bow, 3 torpedo wakes, barely a football field away, still ascending. These had come from very close by. Next to the admiral, a mortified ensign, C.G. Durr, pronounced in resignation, "These have got us." By the time gunnery officer Lieutenant Commander George Knupfer, also standing watch in the tripod mast, saw the torpedoes, they were only 50 yards away. He shouted, "Torpedoes, hard left rudder!" Captain Forrest Sherman belayed that order, shouting for right full rudder. The desperate hope was that the Wasp could still comb the wakes. Answering in the negative were 2 waterspouts rearing high above the superstructure, smoke and flame bursting out amidships, in the words of Wasp fighter pilot Ensign Millard Red Thrash, who, high overhead flying air cover, watched in shock as the torpedoes struck. The first torpedo stung the Wasp near the bow, cracking tanks holding volatile aviation fuel deep within the ship and flooding the forward powder magazines. The concussion and explosion knocked out power in the forward part of the ship, whipsawed the tripod mast, left the unfinished symphony even more unfinished, and threw Ensign Mitchell 30 feet into the air, landing 60 feet away at the feet of Captain Sherman on the bridge's wing. Mitchell broke his leg, but, claimed his crewmates, he set a new world record for distance thrown by an explosion and surviving. The record for a survivor in the last war, Mitchell recalled, was believed to have been 30 feet high and a few feet away. The second torpedo pierced the hull after the first, just in front of the island, cracking open even more aviation gasoline tanks and flooding the forward bomb magazines. Some 20 seconds after the 2 torpedoes hit came a 3rd explosion amidships, its source unclear. Some believe it was a 3rd torpedo that had broached and struck the carrier at or above the waterline. Others believe that it was a detonation of gasoline vapors after only 20 seconds. In any event, the Wasp rocked and reeled, immediately developing a 15-degree list to starboard before coming back a bit to 11 degrees. The carrier also developed what is known as a bow trim, down 10 to 12 feet at the bow. Below decks were filled with the stench of aviation gasoline. The torpedoes had hit the aviation fuel stowage. Burning gasoline leaked from the ruptured tanks and pipes through the lower levels of the carrier and spilled into the ocean beyond, forming a sheet of fire around the carrier. Even worse, the aircraft fueling system had been active. Normally, when combat is expected, the system is drained and filled with carbon dioxide. But combat had not been expected, and the system was engaged to fuel some Wildcats on the flight deck. There were also 16 aircraft, 12 Wildcats and 4 Dauntlesses, fully armed and fueled, on the hangar deck, forward of the number 2 elevator, waiting to be moved to the flight deck. Even with or aft of the elevator were 10 Avengers, armed but not fueled, and 6 Dauntlesses armed and fueled. Suspended from the hangar overhead were 4 spare Wildcats, 2 forward and 2 aft. Not anymore. The concussion from the torpedo hits jarred at least 2 fighters loose from their overhead brackets, sending them crashing to the deck or on top of people, with fatal results, or on top of other parked aircraft, smashing them to pieces and cracking open their own volatile fuel tanks. The remaining aircraft were bodily lifted by the shock to come crashing back to the deck, crushing their landing gear, rupturing their fuel tanks, and releasing more volatile fuel, which promptly caught fire. In some areas, the fuel coming out of the outlets and leaks in the ruptured fuel lines was already burning, like flamethrowers. According to Lieutenant Gross, it was violent. The hangar deck was a wall of fire. In short, the Wasp was like the Japanese carriers at Midway, caught with her hangar deck full of armed and fueled aircraft. The damage control team in the forward part of the ship was not responding. They had been killed when the torpedo struck, or shortly thereafter. The forecastle was almost cut off by fire, trapping Lieutenant Gross and some 50 others, and forcing them to abandon the ship. The central station for handling damage control lost power and had to be abandoned due to fumes and flooding. Brave men rushed into the hangar deck to fight the rapidly spreading conflagration there, only to find their path blocked by a twisted, tangled mess of burning aircraft wreckage that could not be moved. Worst of all, when they brought out the fire hoses, the water only dribbled out of the nozzles. They had no water pressure. The men stood around confused and dumbfounded. For all practical purposes, they had to fight the fires with no water. All this despite the fact that her engines and machinery were still fully operational, and, through some quick transferring of water and fuel loads, her starboard list had been reduced to 4 degrees, and her reserve buoyancy meant there was no immediate danger of sinking. Even so, the situation was, as Admiral Turner might have said, not reassuring, for reasons that soon became apparent. Some 3 to 5 minutes after the initial hits, there was a fuel vapor explosion from deep within the ship, the area of the second and third decks between the island and the number 2 elevator. The blast sent smoke and flames up the bomb elevator to the hangar deck and the flight deck, billowing around the island. A much bigger blast occurred in the same area at 3:05 p.m. that engulfed the island in flaming gases. Admiral Noyes was leaving the bridge and beginning to climb down a ladder when the explosion threw him forward onto the signal bridge, with his shirt, hair, and ears burned. The bridge area had to be abandoned. A quad 1.1-inch mount was blown off its base, with 20mm and 1.1-inch ammunition now cooking off. The third detonation came at 3:10, this one coming amidships, in the neighborhood of the number 2 elevator. It sent up another column, with debris blown as much as 150 feet into the air. The elevator itself was physically lifted to come crashing back down across its original opening, very much the worse for wear. The fire burned through the flight deck on its starboard edge, forward of the island, as 5-inch ammunition in the starboard gun gallery above the first hit started cooking off. So did the 5-inch ammunition in the port side gun gallery. The explosions and fire had destroyed the bulkhead between the hangar deck and the forward part of the ship, allowing the fire to cross the ship completely. The forward part of the carrier was an absolute inferno. Captain Sherman described the Wasp as pretty well shattered from number 2 elevator well down and forward, at least to the splinter deck. He turned the Wasp to try to get the wind to blow the smoke and flames away from the undamaged parts of the ship. She presented a gruesome sight, as seen by the distraught Ensign Thrash overhead. Clouds of bright red fire erupted from both sides below the flight deck, billowing out 200 yards, leaving black smoke streamers and scattering little pools of fire on the water. Sprays of red, yellow, and green very lights shot out like Roman candles. The Wasp's escorts, cruisers Salt Lake City and Helena, and destroyers Lansdowne, Duncan, Fahrenholt, Lardner, and Laffey tried to help. They came and encircled the carrier to prevent further attacks. Unfortunately, the destroyers could not use their fire hoses, as all of the Wasp's fires were internal, some deep within the carrier. The torpedo holes in the starboard side were leaking flaming gasoline on top of the water. Despite Captain Sherman's best efforts to escape the flaming fuel on the sea, the carrier just took it with her. Then there were the explosions, which threatened not just the Wasp, but any ship alongside. At 3:20 p.m., Captain Sherman ordered the Wasp abandoned. The order shocked the men in the engine rooms, who had stayed at their posts and saw little evidence of the carrier's mortal injuries. But they shut down the engine rooms all the same and made their way topside for a second shock when they saw the virtual firestorm the Wasp had become. It took about 40 minutes to get the entire crew off the ship. As was tradition, Sherman himself was the last to leave the ship, immediately after Admiral Noyes. It had taken barely a half hour for a modern warship to be turned into a Pacific pyre. These afternoon events left everyone in both task forces stunned, though none even remotely as much as the men of the Wasp. Their home was now exploding like a 4th of July bonfire, fuel, ordnance, planes, everything. The fighters overhead, including that of Ensign Thrash, headed to the Hornet to protect her. They could not resist sneaking one last look at their home in its death throes. Not that they could see. As Thrash later explained, "My last view of the flat top was blurred with tears. Many of the WASP's crew were in tears. Others were simply dazed, unable to fathom what had happened so quickly to them. Unfortunately, tears and introspection were luxuries the Pacific Fleet could ill afford right now. The WASP now put the other U.S. ships in danger, as her gigantic smoke pall and illuminating fire threatened to act as a beacon for Japanese ships, aircraft, and submarines. The fires continued spreading aft, and at 5:47, there was a massive explosion from below the after-flight deck, according to the destroyer Lansdowne. As the heavy cruiser Salt Lake City recorded it, tremendous explosions, huge column of white smoke or steam above carrier, resulting 3 minutes later in much black smoke, list to starboard about 15 to 20 degrees, series of small explosions. The Helena also noted an extreme volume of smoke coming from the WASP's stern as a result of this explosion, and along with the Salt Lake City, recorded two more detonations on the convulsing carrier at 5:57 and 5:58. Admiral Noyes, now aboard the destroyer Duncan, radioed, "Lansdowne, remain with the WASP. Sink her with your torpedoes. Do not leave her until she has sunk." The Lansdowne had picked up 41 officers and 406 men from the WASP, including much of the carrier's engineering team. The assistant chief engineer confronted the Lansdowne skipper, Lieutenant Commander William R. Smedberg III, saying, "Sir, I secured the engineering plan of that ship, and there's no fire aft or amidships of the ship. I think we can go back on board. I can get that ship underway, and we can get that fire out." Did he know something the other WASP survivors did not? Lieutenant Commander Smedberg gave this information to Admiral Noyes and requested permission to take the engineer and his men back to the carrier and to take the WASP in tow. Evidently unimpressed, Admiral Noyes was adamant. "Sink her." This was to be the first time the Lansdowne fired armed torpedoes. Smedberg called his torpedo officer to the bridge so they together could read the instructions for launching torpedoes. It was apparently considered bad form to read the instructions for launching torpedoes until one had to actually launch them. These torpedoes were supposed to be wonder weapons. The destroyers used the Mark 15, which in turn used the Mark 6 detonator. The Mark 6 included a contact exploder and a magnetic influence feature. This feature was intended to cause the torpedo to detonate when it entered a ship's magnetic field, which was, in theory, under it. The explosion was supposed to fracture the unarmored bottom of the ship, snapping the keel, and causing the ship to break in half. The magnetic influence feature was so secret that, of the men on board the Lansdowne, only Lieutenant Commander Smedberg and the torpedo officer knew about it. Smedberg told his torpedo officer, "Set it for 15 feet under the keel." As WASP's survivors watched in dismay, at 7:08 p.m., the Lansdowne fired a single torpedo at the carrier, from a distance of 1,000 yards. As Smedberg described it, the torpedo, set for a depth of 30 feet, made a perfect flight down to the middle of the carrier, and nothing happened. This wonder weapon was certainly living up to the wonder part of the equation. "Set it at keel depth," Smedberg ordered. The Lansdowne crept closer to about 800 yards and fired. It went right under the middle of the ship, and we never heard a sound. Nothing happened. "Can you make that magnetic exploder inoperative?" The suitably impressed Lieutenant Commander Smedberg asked his torpedo officer. "Can you get rid of it? Obviously, it isn't working." Deactivating the magnetic influence feature of the Mark 6 was a violation of current standing orders, but Smedberg was smart enough to know what was important and otherwise. So was his torpedo officer, who, with his men, deactivated the magnetic influence feature. "We'll fire these set at 10 feet, Smedberg said. The third torpedo detonated exactly where it was supposed to, on the WASP's starboard side, underneath the island, near the original torpedo hits. Smedberg could at least stop wondering about the Mark 6 exploder. However, the torpedo hit had no obvious effect on the listing carrier. It was already going down in the history books as a legendary performance for the Mark 15 torpedo and its Mark 6 exploder. The Lansdowne launched a fourth torpedo. It caused a large explosion on the starboard side. That was still not enough to sink the carrier, leaving the Lansdowne down to her last torpedo. Smedberg maneuvered the destroyer to the opposite side of the carrier and launched. Finally, at 8:15 p.m., the torpedo blew a hole into exactly what it was supposed to, the now exposed unarmored bottom of the badly listing ship. Smedberg edged the destroyer away from the slowly sinking carrier, zigzagging, to try to throw off the aim of the submarine that was out there gunning for him, he guessed, correctly. It was the I-15. But he kept the burning carrier in sight until, after almost 2 hours of work, the Wasp went bow first to her grave at 9 p.m. Much of this Japanese submarine attack of September 15, 1942, was blurred due to several mysteries that were not solved for decades, if at all. One mystery concerns how many torpedoes hit the Wasp, two or three. Captain Sherman reported, "The third torpedo broached and then submerged but was close to the surface when it hit 50 to 75 feet forward of the bridge." The U.S. Navy Bureau of Ships disagreed. About 20 seconds after the torpedoes hit, a third explosion, somewhat less severe, was felt. This was reported by the commanding officer to have been a torpedo, but it is believed to have been of internal origin, inasmuch as the flight deck cover to bomb elevator A-423ET was blown violently upward and flames appeared in the shaft. The question may seem largely academic, and largely unanswerable, except to the extent it relates to a second mystery, the number of submarines involved in the attack. When the Wasp was hit by two or three torpedoes, a fourth was seen to pass the carrier's bow. Shortly thereafter, the light cruiser Helena, off the carrier's port bow, sighted a torpedo passing astern, estimating its course at 60 degrees true, east-northeast. At 2:48, the destroyer lands down, while turning to starboard, saw a torpedo pass under her, bow to stern, also heading 60 degrees true. She estimated it came from bearing 240 degrees true, southwest. The Lansdowne radioed a warning, which was the first one picked up by the Pensacola, but it was garbled enough that it lost the identification and misunderstood the course as 80 degrees true. 2 minutes later, the destroyer Muston, far off the Hornet's port bow, saw a wake off the port bow coming from an estimated 240 degrees true. The wake was seen passing 30 feet astern, indicating the torpedo had passed under her. She hoisted warning flags and radioed an alert, the second one picked up by the Pensacola. 1 minute after that, the O'Brien had to turn hard to starboard to avoid a torpedo that just missed astern. She was unable to avoid a second. Initially, it was believed that the I-19 had hit the Wasp, while the I-15 had hit the O'Brien in North Carolina. This belief was based on a misidentification of the torpedo by the U.S. Navy and the improbability, albeit not the impossibility, of a torpedo from the I-19 missing the Wasp, still having the range to reach the Hornet task force. But after 4 decades and some painstaking research and tracking by the aforementioned Ben Blee of the Pensacola, it was determined that the Lansdowne and Muston saw the same torpedo, one that ultimately hit the North Carolina. Tracked back to its source, this torpedo was originally intended for the Wasp, but missed either astern or under. The torpedo seen by the Helena was one that was either seen by or struck the O'Brien. Again, tracked back to its source, this torpedo was intended to hit the Wasp, but missed ahead. All of these torpedoes came from the same source, Lieutenant Commander Kinashi Takakasu's I-19. Even though Kinashi had no idea the Hornet task force was tucked in behind the Wasp group, or that the vectors of his torpedoes would carry them there. His Type 95s had the range, barely, because when Kinashi launched, his target was almost on top of him, less than 1,000 yards away. The torpedo that hit the North Carolina was at the very end of its run. The I-19's attack was a confluence of skill, superior equipment, and incredible luck, resulting in perhaps the most devastating submarine attack ever launched against the U.S. Navy. Even American observers, when the true origin of the attack was revealed, could only admit, "Well played." As Ben Blee himself said, "Lucky or not, this incredible accomplishment by the I-19 ranks among the all-time record successes of submarine warfare in any Navy. Captain Kinashi, I salute you." The attack would have been still worth the salute, but not nearly as devastating, if not for the third mystery. What caused the complete lack of water pressure in the Wasp's firefighting and fire suppression systems that made fighting the carrier's fires impossible? This was indeed a serious question for U.S. Navy investigators, who summarized that the carrier had an excellent fire main system, hangar sprinkling, and water curtain systems. The Navy postulated, not unreasonably so, that the torpedo hits in the forward part of the Wasp ruptured the fire mains located there. That damage is what caused the lack of water pressure in the fire main system. What Navy investigators found harder to understand was why the damaged part of the system was not isolated, so that the amidships and aft sections of the water main system could continue functioning. Without explicitly saying it, the Navy report implied the reason was human error. One wonders, however, if the assistant engineer who approached Lieutenant Commander Smedberg on the Lansdowne and asked to reboard the Wasp to put out the fire had figured out the issues with isolating the damaged water mains. Torpedoed along with the Wasp was the career of Rear Admiral Lee Noyes. If Admiral King was respected but not liked, Noyes was the opposite, liked but not respected. Admiral King described Noyes as mild and meticulous, but everyone knew he had trouble making decisions. Lieutenant J.G. Thomas R. Wechsler, a junior officer of the deck on the Wasp, found Noyes to be tentative and unsure of himself. It was perhaps for that reason Admiral Noyes had leaned heavily on the Wasp's Captain Sherman, who served as his de facto chief of staff. "I thought Admiral Lee Noyes did not have the big picture," opined Lieutenant Wechsler, "and that Captain Sherman was really the one who was carrying him." In more ways than one, it would seem. In the wake of the Wasp disaster, Admiral Garmley wondered what exactly the Wasp was doing there guarding Admiral Turner's transports, since they could have been protected, he believed, by land-based air power alone. Garmley went on to criticize Admiral Noyes for basically the same reason Lieutenant Gross did, crossing and recrossing the same course track multiple times. Noyes and Captain Sherman defended themselves vigorously, pointing out that the attack took place 150 miles from the nearest point of crossing an old track and in an area which had not been entered or approached previously. But a further issue was in play, underlying why Torpedo Junction had in fact become Torpedo Junction. West of a certain line, command authority changed from Admiral Garmley's South Pacific Command to General MacArthur's Southwest Pacific Command, the creation of which had created a firestorm of its own. Admiral Noyes interpreted his orders from Admirals Nimitz and Garmley to mean he could not cross that line. Given his mild-mannered, non-confrontational personality, Noyes probably did not want to cross that line and possibly create a political incident. In fact, Admiral Nimitz intended no such restriction and had no problem whatsoever with Noyes intruding on MacArthur's zone. This was another instance in which the lack of a unified command, due entirely to the political machinations of Douglas MacArthur and his allies, carried a material cost. The loss of the Wasp stung a Pacific fleet that had still yet to recover from the disabling of the Enterprise and Saratoga. Going down with the carrier were 46 aircraft, 24 Wildcats, 11 Dauntlesses, 10 Avengers, and one Grumman J-2F Duck amphibious biplane. The 25 Wasp aircraft in the air at the time of the attack, 8 Wildcats and 17 Dauntlesses, landed on the Hornet. For the next month, the Hornet would be the only operational U.S. aircraft carrier in the Pacific. And for now, Admiral Turner was very much alone. He had 6 slow, unarmed ships bearing badly needed troops and supplies for the Marines on Guadalcanal. His heaviest escorting ship was a single heavy cruiser, and he had just been stripped of his aerial protection. He and his ships were exceedingly vulnerable. Turner had them head back to the southeast. But not for long. Kelly Turner was unquestionably courageous. He would make the tough decision. He would put himself in harm's way. At 3 p.m. on September 16th, he turned the convoy toward Guadalcanal, risking a Japanese attack. But combined fleet doctrine gave warships much higher priority for submarine attack than supply ships, and the Wasp had just drawn the submarine attack. One can argue the Wasp's sacrifice helped save the convoy. Just before dawn, on September 18th, Admiral Turner and the convoy arrived safely in Lunga Roads. The 4,262 men of the 7th Marine Regiment and their supporting artillery from the 1st Battalion of the 11th Marines made an orderly entrance to Guadalcanal. They were joined by cargo ships McFarland, Tracy, and Bellatrix, bringing in emergency shipments of aviation fuel. It was a highly efficient unloading. The convoy put ashore 3,823 drums of fuel, 147 vehicles, 1,012 tons of rations, 82.5% of the organizational equipment, and nearly all of the ammunition, the first ammunition shipment to Guadalcanal since the invasion. Lieutenant Colonel Twining called it undreamed-of wealth. For good measure, Six Grumman Avengers, formerly of the Saratoga, came in to reinforce the Cactus Air Force. For entertainment, destroyers Monson and McDonough turned their 5-inch guns onto Japanese positions near Kokumbona to the cheers of the Marines at Lunga. After perhaps the second happiest day in the history of Watchtower, Turner's ships left in the early evening, taking with them 162 American wounded, 8 Japanese prisoners, and the battered remnants of the 1st Parachute Battalion. Word of the 7th Marines' arrival on Guadalcanal quickly made its way to Rabaul. Base Air Force responded by launching an air attack, but bad weather turned the Mitsubishis back. The ubiquitous Sendai was sent down with destroyers Shirayuki, Murakumo, Uranami, and Hamakaze. They arrived that night to find nothing. So perhaps, out of boredom, as much as anything else, they exchanged fire with the Marine Coast Defense Batteries at Lunga, with minimal damage to both sides. As they did so, destroyers Arashi, Yumikaze, Kawakaze, and Suzukaze landed 170 men, 4 regimental guns, and supplies at Kamimbo. But now the Japanese faced a much different picture than just 24 hours earlier, with 19,200 Marines defending Henderson Field. Never had the U.S. Marines defending Guadalcanal been so strong. And never had the U.S. Navy defending Guadalcanal been so weak. In Imperial Japanese Army dress uniform, Tsuji Masanobu stepped aboard the giant battleship Yamato, the flagship of the Imperial Japanese Navy's combined fleet. He had been sent from Rabaul. On his shoulders rested the future of the Guadalcanal operation. It had not been a good 2 weeks in Rabaul. The arrival of the rest of the 6th Air Attack Force, 26th Air Flotilla, ended Base Air Force's dark days at the end of August, when it was so low on fighters it had to borrow 30 of them from Kido Butai. All 15 of the remaining carrier fighters returned to their carriers on September 4th. This idea of 2 going out and only 1 coming back was becoming a pattern. General Yakutake's Milne Bay operation had been a disaster, costing the Navy perfectly good, if older, naval infantry, and leaving a detachment of the Special Naval Landing Force troops stranded on Goodenough Island. Admiral Mikawa sent out the destroyers Isokaze and Yayoi to retrieve them, but only the Isokaze came back, with the survivors of the Yayoi, who, just east of Normanby Island on September 11th, had been disabled by a bomb hit from Boeing B-17s and Lockheed Hudsons, and racked with near misses that sent her to the depths. Now came more bad news from Guadalcanal. The defeat of General Kawaguchi's force brought a tectonic shift to Rabaul, which for once had nothing to do with its resonant volcanoes, that resonated all the way to Tokyo. The first reaction was shock. The Americans had defeated the Imperial Japanese Army again? Can they do that? It was followed by another round of finger-pointing. General Yakutake decided to take command of the operation personally. He planned to bring artillery, field guns, 105mm howitzers, 150mm howitzers, and more troops, including the 2nd Sendai Division. This resulted in another series of arguments with the Navy. The Navy insisted on transporting the Sendai Division by its normal method of using destroyers. This was not acceptable to General Yakutake, because it meant transporting little in the way of supplies, and almost no artillery, certainly not the big howitzers the Army wanted. Moreover, with not enough destroyers available, the troops would be transported in a piecemeal fashion. No, Yakutake wanted transports. A large convoy, with a powerful escort of surface ships, to send in the Sendai Division and its artillery in one go. The Navy said it did not have the ships for that. How can we shake a sleeve we don't have? The Navy argued. Finally, General Yakutake, vain and short-tempered as he was, bellowed, "If the Navy lacks the strength to escort the 2nd Division properly to Guadalcanal, we will go in transports without any escort, and 17th Army Headquarters will lead the way." However, Colonel Tsuji, who had been plucked from Guadalcanal after the Kawaguchi attack and taken back to Rabaul, was also quietly watching the conference. He now felt forced to intervene. Tsuji had a better understanding of the conditions there, the jungle, the lack of food, the American air power, than his superiors did. Colonel Tsuji pulled General Yakutake aside. Taking transports to Guadalcanal without protection against American air power was suicide, Tsuji knew. "Let me fly up to truck," Tsuji asked. so he could present Hyakutake's case to Admiral Yamamoto. The general agreed. This he did, on September 24th. He was momentarily awestruck by the size of the Yamato. It was indeed the biggest, most powerful battleship in the world, as it was meant to be, but it never went out to fight. The flagship of the combined fleet had thus acquired the unflattering nickname Yamato Hotel. Tsuji could see why. But his awe passed quickly. Not easily intimidated, certainly not by rank, Colonel Tsuji briefed Chief of Staff Admiral Yugaki and Senior Staff Officer Captain Kuroshima Kameto as to his purpose. Then the colonel was escorted to Yamamoto's cabin. The sight that greeted Colonel Tsuji, at least as he told it, did little to suggest a war going on. He found the admiral, behind the attack on Pearl Harbor, commander of the combined fleet, sitting on the floor of his stateroom, writing haiku. Colonel Tsuji went into his presentation, describing what he had seen, what the men had done on Guadalcanal. Admiral Yamamoto listened quietly, occasionally nodding. "Our supply has been cut off for more than a month," Tsuji said. "Officers and men have to dig grass roots, scrape moss and pick buds from the trees, and drink seawater to survive. The next reinforcement must be transported at one time, troops and supplies, or else it would fail like the Ichiki and Kawaguchi attacks had failed." Colonel Tsuji finished his argument. "I beg you to provide it with a strong escort. If the Navy finds it impossible to do this, then Army Commander Hyakutake is determined to lead the convoy himself and is prepared to be wiped out in his attempt to retake the island." Admiral Yamamoto responded, speaking slowly, as he often did in these situations, "If Army men have been starving through lack of supplies, then the Navy should be ashamed of itself." Tears rimmed his eyes. "Very well. I'll give you cover, even if I have to bring the Yamato alongside Guadalcanal myself." The war for Guadalcanal and the Solomons was about to get much, much bigger. Chapter 7. Why Not? On September 7th, 1942, an older officer walked into the St. Francis Hotel in San Francisco. What made it strange was his uniform. He was wearing an officer's cap with the crest of the U.S. Navy, but it was like no Navy uniform the people around there had seen. It was like a khaki service dress uniform, except it was gray. Charcoal gray pants and jacket, lighter gray shirt, black tie, gray shoulder boards with black stripes of rank. Charcoal gray hat. It certainly matched the personality of the man who wore it, Admiral Ernest J. King, Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Fleet and Chief of Naval Operations. He had personally designed this uniform, which he was modeling this day, as he disliked the khaki service uniforms that had originally been issued, believing the color was more appropriate for land bases. But the gray uniform was generally disliked in the Navy, and it was loathed by the man with whom Admiral King was meeting, Admiral Chester Nimitz, the blue and gold Navy service dress-wearing Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet. Today was the start of one of their periodic conferences, this one of 3 days. The first day was filled with senior personnel matters. King had brought with him Admiral Halsey, finally cured of his lengthy bout of dermatitis, and aching to return to the fight. Nimitz was happy to have Halsey take over his old command, the Enterprise Task Force, once again. There was also a bit of musical chairs. Admiral King was eager to get rid of Rear Admiral John H. Towers, the chief of the Bureau of Aeronautics. Towers had accepted an offer from King to become the commander of the Air Force of the Pacific Fleet, which did not make Admiral Nimitz happy. The current commander, Rear Admiral Aubrey Fitch, was going to move to command the land-based air in the South Pacific, while the current commander there, Admiral McCain, who was close to King, would go to Washington to replace Towers. Everyone clearly still had a seat. Admirals King and Nimitz, with their respective staffs, then went over the South Pacific situation. They took a close look at the disaster at Tsavo Island, especially the lack of intelligence, alertness, readiness, and flag officers, and the deployment. This led to other issues. Calculated risks, or, more accurately, lack of the same, a term Nimitz had used in his orders to Admiral Fletcher before Midway. Inopportune fueling, another reference to Fletcher for which he was now infamous. Mixing forces, lack of coordination of operations. The new cruiser-destroyer attack and screening force, designated Task Force 64, was created around this time, about a month late, grumbled King. The common denominator was Vice Admiral Robert Gormley, the commander of U.S. forces in the South Pacific. Admiral King had soured on Gormley after the South Pacific commander had joined with General MacArthur in that July memo predicting the Guadalcanal campaign would fail, and Gormley had done nothing to improve that opinion. Now King asked Nimitz about Gormley's state. How was he holding up physically and mentally? What was the state of his command and control of the South Pacific forces? For his part, Admiral Nimitz was wondering about Admiral Gormley himself. On September 7th, the South Pacific commander had sent a missive to his superior Nimitz that read more like a session with a psychologist. "I have to spill this to somebody, so I am afraid you will have to be the goat, but I hope you will burn this after it is read." He didn't. Gormley went on to complain that he wasn't getting the support he needed in the South Pacific, and wondered if Admiral King really understood what was happening. He went on to say that the carrier situation was precarious, and then gave the following explanation of why he could not achieve anything. "Some people are probably saying why I don't send surface forces to Guadalcanal in strength at night. The simple reason is, it is too dangerous to suffer possible loss under the present conditions, where they have submarines, motor torpedo boats, surface forces, and shore-based aircraft to aid them in restricted waters." To Nimitz, this would simply have raised more questions. There were no reports of motor torpedo boats, and Gormley was seemingly not taking into account that there was U.S. land-based air available for protection. But perhaps the most disconcerting statement concerned Gormley's view of his authority. "A recent dispatch from Washington told me of several ships that had P-38s on board, but they have never given me authority to divert a ship. I do not want that authority, for in diverting a ship in order to get an airplane, I might divert the very ship that had the critical ammunition in order to tide over a rough situation in Australia." Most commanders want more authority, stretching the bounds of their current authority in order to complete their objectives. Gormley was doing the exact opposite, as if he didn't trust himself with it. With this in mind, Admiral Nimitz told King he would check on how the South Pacific commander was doing. Nimitz also spent time wrestling with Undersecretary of the Navy James Forrestal, who handled procurement, over the Pacific Fleet's constant shortage of oilers. Forrestal managed to wrangle the additional oilers Nimitz needed. The conference concluded shortly thereafter. After giving his staff a free day in San Francisco, Nimitz, Admiral Halsey, and the staff flew back to Pearl Harbor. On September 12th, Nimitz and Halsey went aboard the Enterprise, who had just arrived after Eastern Solomons to repair her battle damage. Nimitz was to award battle decorations. Admiral Halsey had traditionally commanded the Enterprise Task Force. He had sailed the carrier into Pearl Harbor on December 8, 1941, when he and his crew saw the devastation firsthand. He had commanded it for the mission to take Jimmy Doolittle's B-25s to bomb Tokyo. The only reason Halsey had not commanded the Enterprise at Midway and after was because of the annoying dermatitis. The men knew him well. Halsey's outgoing personality made him a natural leader. His aggression and contempt for the Japanese aggressors early in the war buoyed the spirits of his men. Widely regarded as the Pacific Fleet's top carrier commander, and certainly its most popular, Halsey was a breed apart from Admiral Fletcher. Fletcher did everything by the book. Halsey didn't even have a library card. With the men all lined up on deck, Admiral Nimitz stepped to the microphone. He waved for Admiral Halsey, who had been kept hidden, to step forward. "Boys, I've got a surprise for you. Bill Halsey's back." There was a moment of shocked silence as the word sank in. Then, wrote Foster Haley of the New York Times, "officers and men alike forgot decorum and yelled and cheered and whistled until they were hoarse." Admiral Halsey's eyes welled. Tears were not restricted to Americans. On the hill where he had led the Japanese attack, on what would be called Edson's Ridge, and what he called Bald Mountain, the battered, bloodied General Kawaguchi, his uniform in shreds, looked toward the battlefield, bowed his head, and clasped his hands in a prayer for the fallen. There were a lot of fallen on that ridge, the vast majority Japanese, and Kawaguchi knew it. The reports he had received during the night battle had been horrific. Battalion commander killed, battalion completely annihilated, whereabouts of the battalion commander not known. A head count had revealed only some 800 effectives remaining, mostly from Colonel Watanabe's battalion. General Kawaguchi went to find out why. "This powerful battalion," Kawaguchi remembered, "which I had counted on most, was thus completely mismanaged. When I heard of this, I could not help shedding tears of disappointment, anger, and regret." He sent for Colonel Watanabe to get an explanation. but Kawaguchi gave the colonel no chance. As Watanabe approached, Kawaguchi was enraged. "Coward!" he shouted. "Commit harakiri!" But the general relented when he saw Watanabe's condition. The colonel could hardly stand, let alone walk. Watanabe explained the transit through the jungle had injured his feet, and he could not lead his troops. Before the battle, Watanabe had taken his adjutant and two orderlies with him to go find General Kawaguchi. Unable to find the general, Watanabe headed back for his unit, except he got lost in the jungle. Then they were pinned down by American artillery, which Watanabe was unable to escape because his old war wound from Manchuria acted up, so he could not move quickly. He was unable to contact his unit to turn over command, so except for one company, his battalion basically just sat there during the battle and did nothing. Kawaguchi still had to get his remaining men out of the combat zone. And it was most certainly still a combat zone. The last three flyable air Cobras of the 67th had strafed the Japanese troops. Heavy ground fire perforated too and forced them to return to the airfield, where a very busy September 14th, for the Cactus Air Force, though still trying to clean up after the Battle of Edson's Ridge, was about to begin. Two R-4Ds had landed at Henderson Field, bringing in supplies and taking out wounded and captured equipment. One had already taken off when Donald Kennedy, a New Georgia, had sent warning of an approaching Japanese airstrike. Later at 9:21 came another warning, this from Jeffrey Cooper on Santa Isabel, of three aircraft going southeast. That was unusual. The second R-4D had hardly raised its landing gear when it found itself in the sights of a Float Zero, one of three from the Kamikawa Maru, operating out of Rakata Bay on Santa Isabel that our area Air Force had sent on a mission to determine the status of the airfield. The Type 2 was forced to abort his attack by seven intervening Saratoga Wildcats, among the 30 Marine and Navy fighters sent up in response to these alerts. The Float Zeros had no chance, and all were shot down. One Wildcat was forced to land by a burnt-out engine. Next came yet another Japanese reconnaissance mission, this one from Base Air Force. 11 Zeros from the 2nd Air Group, under Lieutenant Kurakane Akira, were launched to make a fighter sweep ahead of Lieutenant Hayashi in his Irving, again trying to determine the status of the airfield. One Zero was forced to ditch, another to abort, and two more had to make emergency landings at Buka, leaving seven to try to sweep two dozen defending Marine Wildcats from the sky. With odds like that, the Japanese were lucky to lose only one Zero, albeit that of another veteran fighter pilot, Petty Officer First Class Magara Koichi. Lieutenant Kurakane's Zeros were long gone before Lieutenant Hayashi arrived to check out the airfield. He looped around the island to approach from the south, but unlike the previous day, Hayashi did not escape notice. Bemused Navy and Marine fighter pilots, who had never seen the twin-engine Nakajima J-1N before, thought it was a German Focke-Wulf. Hayashi's Nakajima ran into a swarm of wildcats as it tried to observe the airfield. Four Grummans peppered the Irving with machine gun fire, leaving it smoking as it entered a cloud and tried to speed away. Two more, Second Lieutenants Kenneth D. Fraser and Willis S. Lees of Marine Fighting 223, chased the Irving for 50 miles at speeds in excess of 200 knots, shooting off pieces of the Nakajima until one of its engines just fell off. Then the Irving went down with no survivors. This seems to have convinced Base Air Force that the airfield was indeed still in American hands. It was around this time that a small motor launch huffed and puffed its way to the dock at Kugum. The boat was assigned to a Corporal Ironi, one of Martin Clemens' scouts, for the purpose of bringing downed aviators back to Henderson Field. In this case, he was bringing back Ace Captain Marion Carl, who had disappeared 5 days earlier. Carl had actually bailed out of his shot-up Wildcat. Ironi had cared for him ever since. The two borrowed a jeep and drove to the pagoda. General Geiger looked up, very pleasantly surprised. He had given Carl up for dead. Then the general gave a puckish smile. Carl was in a friendly rivalry with Major Smith for a top fighter ace. When Carl was shot down, he had 12 aerial victories to Smith's 11. But things had changed during Carl's 5-day absence. Referring to Smith, who was in the room with them, General Geiger said, "Marion, I have bad news. Smitty has 14 now. You still have only 12. "What are we going to do about that?" the general asked. Captain Carl paused for a moment. Then he exploded, "God damn it, General, ground him for 5 days." Grounded fighters was what Admiral Jojima was hoping for. The disappearance of his morning reconnaissance flight had convinced Jojima that the airfield remained unfriendly, so he decided to get our area Air Force to launch further massed air attacks. This one, commanded